Chapter 4, The Beginning of Sorrows. Mine eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he shall pluck my feet out of the net. Turn thee unto me, and have mercy upon me, for I am desolate and afflicted. Psalm of David. 1837. Mary's older sister Abigail married Alexander Hamilton Tilton in the summer of 1837, which united two of the finest families in Sanborton Bridge. The Bakers were doubly pleased, because shortly after Abby's marriage, George returned home and entered into a partnership with Tilton. This was the beginning of the Tilton Woolen Mills, which soon became the town's leading industry and eventually caused the town to be renamed Tilton. The two young businessmen helped Mark Baker with his investments, and he too prospered. But before the second daughter was married in 1842, tragedy struck. Three of the Baker children, Mary, Martha, and Albert, had suffered much from ill health. In the summer of 1841, Albert was again suffering from illness, which proved fatal a few weeks later, on the 17th of October. His death interrupted a brilliant career and was a great loss to the state of New Hampshire, but a greater loss to his family. The year before his demise, he had written to Mary and Martha, "If you knew how much satisfaction I take in reading your letters, you would write oftener, though I never wrote. If there is a brother in this world who is happy in the love of his sisters, it is I. Indeed, it is to me the oasis in the desert of life, the only spot upon which I rest with entire safety. I know there is honesty and sincerity in a sister's love." And now Mary's life seemed a desert without an oasis. She loved all her brothers and sisters dearly, but there had long been a special bond between Mary and Albert. The following year, Mary's dear friend, Augusta Holmes, married Samuel Swasey and moved to Haverhill, New Hampshire. Scarcely a month later, her sister Martha married Luther Pillsbury and moved to Concord. To the former, Mary wrote, "Really, Augusta, you cannot tell how doubly lone I feel since you and Martha have gone. I have tried to forget, sis, but Phoenix-like her image is constantly rising up before me from some desolate vestige. But another year brought the promise of married bliss to Mary." More than 10 years earlier, Brother Samuel had married Eliza Ann Glover, the sister of his young business partner, George Washington Glover. In the intervening years, George had moved to Charleston, South Carolina, and had become exceptionally prosperous as a building contractor. On a visit back home, he had renewed old acquaintances, which included the Baker family. The youngest Baker he had met as a child was now a strikingly beautiful, mature young woman. Their admiration was mutual, and he and Mary began a correspondence. Mark and Abigail were not happy at the prospect of having Mary move so far away, but they were resigned to it by the time the young couple had set the date for the wedding. So in the parlor of her parents' home, which was crowded with friends and relatives, Mary was wedded to George Washington Glover on the 10th day of December in 1843. In later years, she wrote, "I married young, the one I loved." By the end of December, George Glover had brought his bride home to Charleston in the sunny Southland. Before the end of January, something of great moment had taken place in Mary's experience. Perhaps it was that within her own consciousness, she assumed the responsibility of motherhood, which was destined to expand to embrace the whole world. As is so often the case, the import of that moment was seen by no one, including herself, but it was foretold in an imperishable record. In our Bible in stone, the Great Pyramid, there is a passage called the Grand Gallery, which corresponds to the Christian era. The timeline worked out by mathematicians and astronomers places its beginning at the time of the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. At the other end of the Grand Gallery, there is what is known to pyramidologists as the Great Step. Exceedingly accurate mathematical calculations place the beginning of the Great Step at midnight, January 25th to 26th, 1844. Mary had begun the Great Step, but she knew it not. She entered into her new life in South Carolina, and although she missed New England and her childhood home, she was missed much more, as is evident in a letter from her mother. "My ever dear child, will you not be glad to hear again from your aged mother? Dear child, your memory is dearer to me than gold. Everything reminds me of you. Language cannot express my feelings. My sight is almost failed with weeping. And when shall I see you and dear George? I think not very soon, but I rejoice to hear from you so often. Don't write too much for fear it hurts you. How is your health? And how is your back? Can you lie down and rise again without a groan? Do you remember our twilight meeting? It is a precious time to me, for there I feel like meeting with you, and sometimes I fear I worship Mary instead of the great Jehovah." The mental meeting each day at twilight speaks of the strong bond between Mary and her sainted mother. Abigail was to see her youngest daughter far sooner than anyone expected. Little more than a month after this letter was written, her new son-in-law was stricken with yellow fever while the young couple was on a business trip to Wilmington, North Carolina, and 9 days later, George Glover expired, the attending physician stating that it was nothing but his wife's prayers that kept him alive that long. Mrs. Glover thought in poetry more than in prose, and her journal entry at this time was, "Thoughts at a grave. Spread o'er the turf the spirits fetterless, and free to range the golden streets of heaven. A higher boon than earth to it was given, tenant of loathsome clay. From sin how blessed to be away. Ye stricken ones who sorrow o'er the sod, no love of thine outweighs the love of God. It is for thee, meek at this mystery, of heaven's dark fiat, calmly to submit. Linger not here. Go forth, and to thy duty once again, say unto youth, say to the hoary head, prove faithful to the living as the dead. George Glover's Masonic brethren opened their hearts and their homes to his bereaved widow, which helped her through those first few days and weeks. She was ever grateful for their kindnesses, which extended even to escorting her to her parents' home in New England. What a bittersweet reunion with her family. But her thoughts turned always to God, as expressed in the widow's prayer, which she wrote at this time. For trials past, I would not grieve, but count my mercies o'er, and teach the heart thou hast bereaved, thy goodness to adore. Thou gavest me friends in my distress, like manna from above. Thy mercy ever I'll confess, and own a father's love. Her brief marriage seemed almost like a beautiful dream with a sad ending. Though she was back in Sanborton Bridge, her thoughts were not, as she penned, "Wind of the South." Ye scenes my heart still loves to own, ye scenes which thrill deep notes of woe, departed joys, blessed friendships flown, sad in the south wind murmur low. Yet stay, ah, whither wouldst thou roam? Gay, restless essence, bounding free? Bliss to my bosom were the boon of wings to wander back to thee. Yes, balmy breeze, when evening glows, oh, pitying come and kiss my cheek. But no, thy sighing would disclose thee hither from the grave I seek. Oh, say, do worms dare revel round the casket where no gems can rust? Hath loveliness a level found beneath the cold and common dust? The following September, on the 12th of the month, Mary gave birth to a healthy son. But everyone feared for the mother's life. Mahala Sanborn, who had been domestic servant and family nurse for the Bakers for many years, was Mary's special nurse for the next several months. While the baby, who had been named George Washington Glover II after his father, was given over to the care of a Mrs. Morrison, who had recently lost one of her infant twins. In time, when Mary's health was sufficiently recovered, baby George was brought home. But his care fell largely to Mahala and Abigail. Much as Mary yearned to be a perfect mother, the story of her womanhood was the same as that of her youth, one of health, or the lack of it. George, though a sturdy baby, was a difficult one whose lusty screams filled the house. The fact that he could not be comforted may have been a reflection of Mary's own state of consciousness. Her gay laughter and light spirit, which had always been characteristic in spite of her physical suffering, were oftentimes clouded by an underlying melancholy which persisted for many years. In a letter to her friend, Martha Rand, she wrote, "Now, dearest Matthew, I have half determined this very moment to throw aside my pen and wait to weep. But then, what availeth this mood? 'Tis like looking down through transparent waters of the sea of life, checkered with sunshine and shade, into the mighty deep, in which our happier days have sunk, and where they are lying still visible like golden sands, and half in hope, grasp after them again, then draw back the hand, filled only with briny tears. One day, a young man stopped by to visit his friends, the Bakers. Georgie was howling inconsolably, and with Mary's permission, the young man took him from her arms into the next room. She heard him say to the child, "I know what you want. You want a father. You want your papa. I am going to be your father, little man. I'll be your papa." This impressed both Mary and the baby, for he quieted down and was somewhat calmer in the future. But George's future was as uncertain as was that of his mother. In her grief, Mary had given no thought to her husband's property, and it was lost to her. Thus, the problem that confronted her now was support for herself and son. In 1845, Sanborton Academy was replaced by the New Hampshire Conference Seminary. The following year, the principal, Reverend Richard Rust, prevailed upon Mrs. Glover to substitute for his leading teacher during the latter's absence of several weeks. He paid Mrs. Glover a fine compliment on her work and encouraged her to continue teaching. Mary's independence of thought, combined with her parental responsibilities, caused her to think in terms of education for the very young. With the help of her sister, Abigail, she secured a building, had it painted and equipped, and opened what was probably America's first kindergarten. Her ideas were revolutionary for that time, and her school attracted considerable attention. The word kindergarten was not then in the American vocabulary, and encyclopedias now say that the first kindergartens in America were begun in the 1860s. But Mrs. Glover pioneered the concept nearly 20 years earlier with her successful infants' school in 1846. Mary's health did not allow her to continue teaching for any length of time, and the care of George fell largely to Mahala Sanborn, who had him with her often in her father's home and blacksmith shop. As a source of income, Mary turned more to her writing. Mary Glover's article, "The Immortality of the Soul," appeared in the May 1847 issue of The Covenant. The following excerpts give an indication of the trend of her thought. "Who does not sometimes conjecture what will be his condition and employment in eternity? Will the mind be continually augmenting its stock of knowledge and advancing toward complete perfection? It cannot be otherwise. We shall there apprehend fully the relations and dependencies incomprehensible to understandings, encircled by clay. The boundless ocean of truth will be fathomed and investigated by those whom, like Newton, a residence here, scarcely acquainted with a few pebbles in its trackless shore. The result of all experiments will then be satisfactory, since they will accord with the deductions of enlarged and enlightened reason. Most authors have but dimly shadowed forth their own imaginings, and much of what they intended is involved in obscurity. This makes an approach to the regions of science and literature so extremely difficult. There, this obstacle will be removed. No veil will hide from our observation the beauties, lovely, inimitable of wisdom and philosophy. All their charms will there be displayed. The imperfection of language will be no hindrance to the acquisition of ideas, as it will no longer be necessary as a medium of thought and communication. Intelligence, refined, etherealized, will converse directly with material objects, if indeed matter be existent. All will be accessible, permanent, eternal. At the age of 25, we find Mrs. Glover using the term science as something most desirable to be sought after, nearly 2 decades before her great discovery of the science of man. Here, too, she is doubting the permanence or perfectibility of matter. Mary and John Bartlett had been friends since childhood, but she was not considering him as a husband. About the time that John departed for his final term at Harvard Law School, Mary wrote to her sister Martha, "I feel as if I must begin something this summer, if my health is sufficient. I am weary working my way through life from the middle to the end. I shall not marry anyone I know at present. The future, however, may do better by me in this respect." John, it seems, had other ideas. In August of 1848, Mary traveled to Cambridge to attend John Bartlett's graduation from Harvard. He had made a brilliant record at law school and had the promise of a fine future. Family and friends were expecting the young couple to marry, and Mary was changing her mind, for her mother wrote of the situation to George, "I think her mind is fully established." But John was not yet established and did not yet have the means to provide a home for a wife and son. The battle for health was nothing new to Mary. She had never been free from it for any length of time. But in the spring of 1849, she seemed to be losing the fight. Her parents sent her to Warner, New Hampshire, for 2 months under the care of Dr. Parsons Whitten. Abigail reported to George that the doctor says she could not live long as she was. She seems to have found some relief, for by the end of summer, she was engaged to marry John H. Bartlett. He was going to the fabulous California of 1849 to establish a law practice in Sacramento. She had chosen a new course for her future, but the coming weeks and months would be filled with days of waiting. Not so for the rest of the Bakers. Mark was building a fine new house in town, though Abigail was not feeling well. She was preparing for a wedding. For George, who had left Sandwarden Bridge 2 years earlier, was coming home to marry Martha Rand. The wedding took place on the 4th of November, and George left with his bride immediately for Baltimore, little knowing the sad news he would receive from Mary before the month's end. November 22nd, 1849. My dear bro, this morning looks on us bereft of a mother. Yes, that angel on earth is now in heaven. I have prayed for support to write this letter, but I find it impossible to tell you the particulars at this time. She failed rapidly from the time you saw her, but her last struggles were most severe. Her physician spoke of it as owing to so strong a constitution. Oh, George, what is left of earth to me? But oh, my mother, she has suffered long with me. Let me then be willing she should now rejoice, and I bear on till I follow her. I cannot write more. My grief overpowers me. Write to me. Your affectionate sister, Mary. Died last night at 7:30. Will be buried next Saturday. I wish you could be here. Abigail Baker was indeed an angel on earth. She was one of those rare individuals who was loved by everyone. Even Mrs. Eddy's bitterest critics have had no word to say in condemnation of Abigail Ambrose Baker. This was the greatest loss that Mary had yet sustained. And from her pen came, "To my mother in heaven." Two of the seven stanzas read, "The wild winds trace the stars which light their shining lamps on high. Point to thy rest, thy being bright, thy home beyond the sky. And all with mournful memories blent, no hopes of earth restore. Oh, winds and stars may wander by, thy footsteps are no more. I bless thee, mother, precious guide, for my most sacred share. In all the secrets of thy heart, thy sorrow and thy prayer, supporting faith be mine below, life's parting words to greet. Thy mantling virtues o'er me throw, till child and mother meet." Her griefs and heartaches were with her in San Borton, but Mary's hopes for the future, if she could muster any, lay in Sacramento with John Bartlett. But the news that she received from California in December was not from John, but about him. On the 11th of the month, John H. Bartlett had died in Sacramento. With the obituary she wrote for the New Hampshire Patriot, Mrs. Glover included these words: "The young man was engaged to the daughter of an aged friend." The daughter survived both mother and lover. The mother dying first, in 2 weeks he followed. This was accompanied by a poem entitled, "The Meeting of the Two Spirits," in which the mother asks the young man, "Bearest thou no tidings from my loved of earth, the desolate whose stricken joys have dearth? What of my child?" Life was desolate for Mary, but this was not the end of her sorrows. Little did she know that this very poem, revised, would apply again in her experience. But desolation has its reward. In later years, she was able to write, "It is well to know, dear reader, that our material mortal history is but the record of dreams, not of man's real existence, and the dream has no place in the science of being."